I'm Nathan Rutherford, and welcome to Myth Madness. Last episode, I talked more about the Hurrians, and introduced a group of myths called the Kumarbi Cycle. These myths tell of the kingship in heaven, and the attempts of successive generations of gods to gain and hold on to the kingship. The first myth starts with the god Alalu as king. He is deposed by An, who then, in turn, is deposed by Kumarbi. During his attempted takeover, Kumarbi ate An's genitals and became pregnant from this. He later gives birth to multiple gods in a pretty dramatic fashion. One of those gods was Teshub, the Hurrian storm god. Kumarbi tries to eat the baby Teshub, but is tricked by the wise god Ea into biting a rock instead. Teshub grows up and becomes the champion of the gods aligned against Kumarbi. He eventually gains the kingship through fighting, and probably also the support of Ea. However, it is not going to last. Kumarbi, while defeated, has not disappeared, and he is going to continue agitating against Teshub. And then, Teshub himself actually provides Kumarbi with an opening. Teshub is overheard, arrogantly saying that none of the other gods can oppose him, not Kumarbi, and not Ea either. News of Teshub's outburst eventually gets back to Ea, who is not at all impressed. A rift between the two gods forms, and Ea begins to move into the camp of Kumarbi and his followers. The next Hurrian myth is usually thought of as taking place right after these events. This one is called the Song of Lamma. Lamma is not actually a name. Instead, it refers to a symbol that the text uses as a substitute for the god's name. He is going to be one of the main characters of this myth. It's not clear what the name of the god actually is, but we can make a decent guess. This story is believed to come from Hurrian communities near Carchemish, a major city in the ancient Middle East in what is now northern Syria. A goddess named Kubaba was from the same area and is also going to be featured in this story. Kubaba was one of the many foreign gods that was pulled into the Hittite and Hurrian pantheons. Kubaba was the wife of a god named Karhui. When she talks to Lamma later in this story, she is likely advising him as a wife to a husband. So Lamma's real name might very well be Karhui. Unfortunately, we are missing the beginning of this Song of Lamma, this Song of Karhui myth. But we can safely assume that Teshub is king in heaven. Kumarbi has not disappeared like the previous defeated kings in heaven, but he does lack the power to defeat Teshub himself. Instead, he is forced to slink away, plot against Teshub, and instigate conflicts between Teshub and the other gods. Most likely, Lamma Karhui is one of these gods. The readable parts of the myth start with Lamma's surprise attack on Teshub. Teshub is speaking with his sister, the goddess Shashka, when suddenly an arrow flies through the air and pierces Shashka in the chest. Teshub and Shashka flee across the sky in Teshub's chariot. Another arrow speeds past them. This one doesn't hit either of them, but the arrow hits an important part of the chariot, probably the wheel, and breaks it. The chariot slowly comes to a stop. These arrows were shot by Lamma. He now throws a large rock at Teshub. The rock misses Teshub, but strikes the sky, making it shake. The sky shakes so much that the storm god falls out of the sky and falls to earth far below. Teshub is dazed from his fall, and with his rival now weakened, Lamma can approach the storm god. Teshub is unable to do anything, while Lamma takes the reins and whip from Teshub's hands. This is important. These items, the reins and the whip, are sacred and symbols of the kingship. By taking them, Lamma is taking over. Also, reins and a whip were tools used by Teshub to drive his chariot. In a lot of societies, symbols for royalty are often swords, spears, a crown. In this case, we have tools used to guide and control horses. It really just shows how important chariots were in Hurrian society. So Lamma takes the reins and whip from a defeated Teshub, but Teshub is conscious enough to whisper something to Lamma. Teshub says, "You have taken my reins and whip. Do not let a woman eat sheep sacrificed to those reins." What is Teshub doing here? It seems that these special symbols of the heavenly kingship, this rein and whip, may have had their own cult, or at least been the center of some cult to kingship itself. And offerings and sacrifices were made to them. Here, Teshup is giving instructions to Lama, telling him how to oversee that the offerings are done properly. At this point, we have a large break in the tablets recording this story. This section probably told how the wise god Ea, the god who grew upset with Teshup at the end of last episode, officially appoints Lama to be the new king of the gods. The next readable part of the tablet explains that Lama is happy to hear Ea's words, probably the news that Lama was now king. Lama had a great feast to celebrate. He ate and drank, and then went up into heaven to ascend the throne. For 9 years, Lama was king in heaven. In those years, the world is described as a peaceful paradise. At night, wolves lie down to sleep with the sheep instead of trying to eat them. Cloth is of high quality, and everyone wears fancy clothes. The rivers of the mountains flow with beer, and the rivers in the valleys flow with drink too. Mankind was well off and content. Now, back in the Telepino episode, I talked about how in ancient times, in this part of the world, life was really difficult. The climate could be harsh, famines were common, and in bad weather, entire towns and villages could be cut off from the outside world. I talked about how people believed their survival rested on the whims of gods. Keep the gods happy, and hopefully life wouldn't be so hard. But when life is easy, is there any need to honor the gods? For the Hittites and Hurrians, apparently not. With Lama reigning in heaven, and prosperity everywhere else on earth, humans began to neglect the gods. And because of that, trouble begins to build. The great gods, the primeval gods, are forced to take action. After all, if humans stop honoring the gods and providing offerings and sacrifices, what are all the gods going to eat? They're not going to start making their own sandwiches. One day, the goddess Kubaba lifted her eyes and looked out her window. She saw the great primeval gods approaching from across a far-off distance, coming to complain to their king, Lama. Concerned, she goes to Lama and tells him to go meet his forefathers and bow to them, to show them the respect they deserve, and to listen to their concerns. Lama replies that the primeval gods are great, but that he does not fear them at all. Lama says, "Don't I put bread in their mouths? It is I, Lama, king of heaven that provides for the gods. It is I who tells the winds to come and go." Sounds like power is going to Lama's head. And remember, previously it was arrogance that led to Teshub's downfall too. Sure enough, one of the great gods, Ea, overhears Lama say this to Kubaba. And like with Teshub before, Ea is not impressed and becomes angry. It is at this point that Kumarbi resurfaces again. Even in defeat, Kumarbi seems to have a lot of influence and power in the world of the gods. Ea went to Kumarbi. He arrives at Kumarbi's palace and enters Kumarbi's audience chamber. Ea tells him, "Come, Kumarbi, let us go back to the palace of the gods. This Lama, who we together made king in heaven, is complacent, and he has made the country complacent. No one gives bread and drink offerings to the gods anymore." In other words, while Lama is now king in heaven, and even though the world is described as a paradise for mankind, Lama arrogantly does not honor the other gods. And because of that, humans have stopped honoring them too. Ea cannot have this situation continue. Kumarbi agrees. The two of them head to different cities. Ea went to Apsuwa, and Kumarbi went to Tuttle. These were both Hurrian towns. What they both did in those cities is not clear, but essentially they are preparing a coup d'etat. Maybe they're looking to gain support for this among the other gods, and are hoping to overthrow Lama together. Afterwards, Ea sends a messenger to Lama. The message is that ever since they made him king in heaven, Lama has not done anything. He has never called an assembly of the gods. Ea goes on and on listing the shortcomings of Lama's 9-year reign. And with that, Ea pulls his support. Ea then sends his vizier, Izumi, down to the Dark Earth, the Underworld, to tell his brother, Nera-Napshara, what he has done. Izumi explains the reasons for Ea's actions. He also instructs Nera-Napshara to mobilize all the animals of the earth and build an army. They are to meet at Mount Nesalma, where they will battle with Lamma and depose him from the kingship. The tablet breaks off here, and the ending is not clear. We can guess that Teshub eventually either found out about Ea pulling his support from Lamma, or is recruited by the gods to lead them in battle against Lamma at Mount Nesalma. But before the battle, Teshub calls his vizier, the god Ninurta, and they fight Lamma together, likely in a chariot. Teshub eventually defeats Lamma in battle and resumes the kingship in heaven. Teshub, now chastened from his time being pushed from the throne, now at least listens to the concerns of the other gods, and the humans return to honoring the gods too. The world returns to its natural order, even if it makes the lives of humans harder. That's the Song of Lamma. Lamma deposed Teshub, ruled for 9 years, and then, once he is revealed to be a bad ruler, from the perspective of the gods, Ea and Kumarbi pull their support, build a coalition, and Teshub defeats Lamma. Here we have Kumarbi briefly putting away his hatred for his son Teshub to side with the other gods against Lamma. You might think the father and son are now reconciled. Teshub is king and now more humble, Kumarbi has embraced his retirement, Ea and the other great gods are respected, and humans honor the gods. It's a brave new world. But I'm sorry to say, the Grand Coalition does not last. Kumarbi still plans for Teshub to be removed from power. And Kumarbi is not alone. He has allies, too. In the next two myths, his strongest ally is the sea god, Kiyashi. His name literally means sea. The next myth is called the Song of the Sea. Unfortunately, the written text of this song is completely missing. Fortunately, though, there are clues about its plot found in other Hittite texts. The Song of the Sea featured a conflict between Teshub and Kiyashi. The story may have featured Kiyashi causing a great flood, with water that grows higher and higher until it reaches all the way to heaven and threatens to drown the sun, the moon, and the stars. But eventually, Kiyashi is defeated by Teshub, and he returns to the sea. Teshub may have defeated the sea god by using a powerful and ancient weapon. It's not clear what that weapon could be or where he got it, although Ea is probably the one who would provide such a weapon. But apparently, afterwards, this weapon was stolen from Teshub. Mountain gods fight against Teshub's rule and use this same weapon against him, but he remains king. But after Kiyashi was defeated, Kumarbi, who still has influence over the assembly of gods, ordered a tribute of gold, silver, ivory, and lapis lazuli, a valuable blue stone, to be paid to Kiyashi. The sea god will remain Kumarbi's ally going forward. Kumarbi goes on to create children he hopes will remove Teshub from power. Maybe those mountain gods that fought Teshub with the mystery weapon were also Kumarbi's sons. I don't know, but it would fit in with the rest of the Kumarbi cycle. The next myth in the Kumarbi cycle, though, does undoubtedly feature a son of Kumarbi. The next myth is called the Song of Hidamu. Once again, the whole story is not known, but lots of copies of this story were written down. Most of the time, Hittite and Hurrian myths were told orally. Usually there was no need to write a lot of these stories down because people knew them and told them so well. But the Hittite scribes must have really liked the Song of Hidamu, and helpfully for us, wrote it down several times. What survives to us today are lots of small, discontinuous fragments of story that can be pieced together to give a basic idea of the plot. Scholars do disagree slightly on the order of some of these fragments. I've combined them here in a way that makes the most sense to me. Before we begin, though, I should introduce another Hurrian deity who will play a major role in this myth. That deity is the goddess Shashka. I've mentioned her a few times already. Although there is absolutely nothing in the Song of Birth to explain who Shashka's parents were or how she was born, she is presumably the daughter of Kumarbi. In various places in Hurrian myths, Shashka is described as the sister of Teshub and Tashmishu, and she is closely tied to the city of Nineveh in Mesopotamia. She is a goddess associated with war and sex. Naturally, in art, there are two ways of depicting her, either as a naked woman or wearing armor, wielding a mace, and having a lion as a special symbol. She was important to the Hittites too. Her Hittite version was named Enzili. But Shashka was originally Hurrian, and Enzili was probably at first a different goddess. The name Enzili appears as the wife of one of the sons of the Hittite storm god Tarhun. Meanwhile, the Hurrian Shashka is rarely married to anyone. There is one myth where she fights against a mountain god named Pisheshapi when he tries to rape her. Now you know a little bit more about Shashka, let's go back to the Song of Hidamu. So far, I've covered a couple Kumarbi myths. The first myth, the Song of Birth, explained the rise of Kumarbi, how he gave birth to Teshub, and it implied his fall from the throne. After that, Kumarbi was not defeated, but instead goes on to plot and scheme and seek his revenge on Teshub. A handful of different gods rise up against Teshub, and Kumarbi is suspect number one in setting these conflicts up. Now, as you might imagine, god versus god conflicts are generally not good for the surrounding environment. They are destructive, brutal, and end up with a lot of collateral damage. When I talked about these kinds of battles in Greek mythology, they were full of details like the earth splitting open, floods and fires, islands and mountains being thrown through the air, and plenty of human suffering. You can imagine the same thing happening in these Hurrian myths too. You can also imagine that the various Hurrian gods are getting a little fed up with the destruction, and with Kumarbi always the one starting it. Eventually, it is none other than Ea, the old and powerful kingmaker, who calls an assembly of all the gods to discuss. First, Ea, the king of wisdom, got up and spoke to all the assembled gods together. "Why are you destroying mankind?" he asked. "If they are destroyed, they won't give offerings to the gods. They won't burn incense. There will be no one left to worship the gods and provide us with offerings of bread and libations of water. Without humans, we, the gods, will have to do all the work ourselves. To get wheat, Teshub will have to take up the plow and work the fields. To make bread, Shashka and Habat will have to work the grindstones to make flour." The gods looked around at each other, no doubt whispering amongst themselves. Without humans, they would actually have to work. Terrible. No can do. Thanks, but no thanks. Having captured their attention, Ea then turned to speak to Kumarbi. Ea asked why he, Kumarbi, was seeking to harm mankind. Didn't humans offer grain to Kumarbi too? In fact, didn't humans go into temples and specifically make offerings directly to Kumarbi alone? And didn't they make offerings to Kumarbi not just because it was their duty, but because they liked Kumarbi and took joy in making the offerings? Ea tells Kumarbi he should put wisdom before the blood and tears of mankind. But Ea's words have the wrong effect. Instead of shaming Kumarbi on his past actions, they only serve to make Kumarbi angry and more determined in his plans. After hearing Ea, Kumarbi thinks to himself, "Why would you, Ea, boil at me in front of all the gods? Why would you strike out at me, Ea? Why would you defend mankind? To me, Kumarbi, son of Alalu." Kumarbi is greatly offended. He feels his honor and standing among the gods was disrespected. Kumarbi is going to show just how great he is. He decides to raise up another rival against Teshub. But first, he has to put his new plan in motion, and the first step of any good plot is to hold a secret meeting. First, Kumarbi told his vizier Mukeshanu to go to Kumarbi's house, the temple in Nippur, and drive away the snakes, to close all the windows that are facing the city of Kumi, and to close all the doors which are facing Nineveh. When the meeting happens, Teshub of Kumi cannot overhear what is discussed, and Shashka of Nineveh may not hear either. Afterwards, sealing it off from potential eavesdroppers, Kumarbi tells Mukeshanu that he is to go into the house and prepare things to eat and drink. Mukeshanu does all that. He fills vessels with beer. He piles bread on tables. Finally, Kumarbi tells his vizier, his trusty attendant Mukeshanu, to carry a message to Kiyashi, the sea god. Mukeshanu heard his master's words. He promptly stood up, and, remaining unseen, he made his way down to the sea. Mukeshanu arrived at Kiyashi's palace and spoke to the sea. "Come, the father of the gods, Kumarbi, calls you. And the matter he calls you It is an urgent matter. Come promptly. Do not let Khushu the moon, Istanu the sun, or the gods of the earth see you. Come up to Kumarbi from beneath river and earth. When Kiyashi heard Mugashanu's words, he understood. He stood up promptly and made the journey to see his old ally in one trip. Kiyashi came up to Kumarbi's house. The servants set a throne for Kiyashi to sit, and the great sea god sat on this throne. They set a table for him to eat, and the cupbearer gave him sweet wine to drink. Kumarbi, the father of the gods, and the great sea god sat eating and drinking their fill. After the meal was finished, Kumarbi instructed his vizier to bolt the door and throw the latch, to not even let a scent leave the house. Kumarbi and the sea's secret meeting was ready to begin. He shares his plans with Kiyashi. The sea god heard Kumarbi's plan, and in his head he rejoiced. He laid his foot out on a stool, and Kiyashi replied to Kumarbi, "Our matter is settled. Kumarbi, father of the gods, come to me in 7 days, to my house in the sea, and I will give you my daughter, Shirtap Shirui." The sea god goes on to describe his daughter. He gives the dimensions of her waist as 1 mile across. Very impressive. But it means that Shirtap Shirui is some kind of giant or supernatural creature. Kiyashi says Kumarbi will drink her like sweet cream. Kumarbi heard the sea god's words and was pleased with their arrangement. So Kiyashi, the sea god, was escorted out of Kumarbi's house. He was accompanied by music played on lyres, drums, and cymbals, all the way to his own house. When the sea god returned home, he sat in a beautiful chair and looked forward to Kumarbi's visit 7 days later for his marriage to Shirtap Shirui. We can now fast forward a bit in time to after Kumarbi's marriage to Shirtap Shirui and their conception of a child. There was likely more story here, but the fragments do not cover it. A pregnant Shirtap Shirui stayed with her father in the sea. When she is ready to give birth, Kiyashi sends a messenger to go bring Kumarbi. When Kumarbi heard the words, he rewarded the messenger with gold. He then went down to the sea in secret. His child was born and brought to sit on Kumarbi's knees. Kumarbi lifted the boy up and played with the child, bouncing him up and down and amusing the baby. The child of Kumarbi and Shirtap Shirui was named Hidamu, a Hurrian word meaning serpent. And he is a huge sea serpent. Kumarbi leaves his new monster son to be raised in the sea, at home in the deep water. And so they raise Hidamu. They anoint him with oil, they place him in water, and they wrap him up like how a farmer wraps an apple tree to protect it from the cold. They feed him. Hidamu eats cows and horses by the thousand. He raises up fish, snails, and frogs from the depths of the sea. By the thousands he eats them, swallowing them down like honey. The sea serpent grows larger, and after a period of time, the goddess Shashka learns of Hidamu's existence. She realized she must warn her brother at once. Shashka arrived at the house of Teshub. Teshub's servants welcomed her into the home. They placed a chair for her to sit, but she did not sit. They laid food on a table for her to eat, but she did not reach for anything. They offered her a cup, but she did not lift the cup to her lips. Shashka was obviously agitated. To ignore the normal rituals of good hospitality meant that something was very seriously wrong. Teshub asked his sister why she did not eat, why she did not drink, and Shashka replied, "Why is there eating? Why is there drinking? Don't you know Kiyashi is against the gods? There is a rival to you in the sea." She continued on to describe the monster Hidamu to Teshub. After Teshub heard about the appetites of the sea serpent and the destruction he had already caused, Teshub began to cry. Afterwards, Teshub does something unexpected. He searches for his rival and father Kumarbi. Teshub finds Kumarbi as he returns from one of his many trips to the sea. Teshub asks him, "Father of the gods, where were you? Who is he, this enemy?" Kumarbi, probably quite pleased with himself, tells the storm god the truth, that he, Kumarbi, has raised a serpent to fight against Teshub. Later, Teshub returns from meeting Kumarbi, now knowing the full extent of the threat facing him. Hidamu is not just any old monster. He is big, strong, and hungry. And he is a son of Kumarbi, a son whose entire purpose is to defeat the storm god. Teshub is afraid of this new threat, and he speaks with his sister, Shashka. Teshub told Shashka there will soon be a great battle. Hidamu and I will engage in conflict. Hidamu will seek to destroy me. If I win, Hidamu will be unable to run rampant and all the gods will be saved. But if Adamu wins, it will be my fault. Teshub goes away, unsure of how to face his rival, but to ready himself for battle nonetheless. But Shashka wasn't going to just stand around and leave the fate of the universe to the outcome of a great battle between her brother and a fierce and destructive sea serpent. Shashka had her own ideas on how to help. Shashka went to the bathhouse. She washed herself. She anointed herself with fine, perfumed oil. She dressed. It's described that those qualities which arouse love ran after her like puppies. She got her female attendants, two goddesses named Ninata and Kulita, to accompany her to the seaside. She told them to bring instruments, and when they reached the sea, Shashka ordered her companions to play the cymbals on her right side and the drums on her left. Shashka herself begins to sing beautiful songs, and all of heaven and earth sang songs in response. With all the music, the pebbles of the earth quake. Shashka muses, "Perhaps Hidamu will hear our song." Well, he did hear them. Hidamu heard and raised his head from the watery deep. He spied Shashka, standing by the side of the sea. Shashka looked out and saw the great sea serpent approaching. No doubt she was pleased to have gotten his attention. So far, her plan was working. Shashka pulled aside her clothes and showed off her naked body to Hidamu. And that really got the sea serpent's attention. He swam a bit closer. Hidamu spoke to Shashka. "What god are you? Are you not afraid?" But Shashka just continued. She did not show any fear. Finally, Hidamu said, "Run away, woman, run away. I will eat you up." But Shashka did not run away. Hidamu asked, "What kind of woman are you?" And Shashka replied, "I am an angry young woman. The mountains spread out their greenery for me like a woven cloth." Shashka spoke flattery to Hidamu, praising him with words. Imagine things like, "Oh, Hidamu, what large eyes you have. Oh, Hidamu, what large teeth you have. Oh, Hidamu, what a strong body you have. Those scales, so shiny and smooth. Oh my." Between the nakedness and the flirting, Hidamu forgot his hunger for food for a moment. He was starting to feel a very different hunger. Hidamu asks her, "What woman are you? Tell me your name." Shashka told him. She also told him they will go together to the mountains. They will sleep together, soothe each other, that even a dream would not release them. A spear, thrown, would leap away from their bodies. When Shashka, the queen of Nineveh, thought it was a good time, she mixed a potion. She got closer to the sea and dissolved it in the waters. Hidamu tasted the scent, tasted this beer, and sleep overcame him. Now drunk on the potion, he recognized nothing and went back to eat his fill of frogs and lizards in the deep sea. But Shashka called out to Hidamu, telling him to come up again, but this time not to just come up to the surface, but to come right up out of the powerful waters of the sea. Hidamu returned, brought his full serpentine bulk out of the ocean, and Shashka once again showed him her naked body. Hidamu stared at the beautiful goddess, and his hunger for her grew stronger. He got an erection. Shashka walked away in front of Hidamu, and Hidamu followed her. We can assume that they go on to have a lot of sex. Hidamu impregnates her with 130 cities. How you can impregnate someone with an entire city, I have no idea. But they continue. And Hidamu fathers another 70 cities. We are even given a hard-to-read but pretty gross detail that says Hidamu ejaculated so much semen that it poured out on the earth like a frightful flood. I told you it was gross. But Shashka's plan is complete. Using her own beautiful body, and with a little help from an alcoholic love potion, Shashka has led Hidamu fully out of the sea and onto dry land. The serpent's guard is down, and without the sea to cover him, he is now very, very vulnerable. The tablet fragments end here, but we can safely say that Hidamu was defeated. We can assume that at this point, with Shashka's trick on Hidamu complete, Teshub was now free to appear and kill the drunk, tired, and weakened sea serpent. Together, Shashka and Teshub were successful in saving the gods and the world from a monster and another revenge plot from Kumarbi. But it won't be the last. Next episode, I will pick up with the last myth of the Kumarbi cycle. If you're enjoying this podcast, please get the word out and tell your friends. And while you're at it, if you could head over to Apple Podcasts and give the pod a 5-star review, I would greatly appreciate it. Stay tuned for next time, and thank you for listening.